This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
It's 11:30 a.m. on Sunday morning, which means that it's time for Out of the Blue, a show bringing you the word from our coasts and oceans. My name is Tessa Campisi. My voice is beaming to you from the unceded lands and waters of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people, and I pay my respect to elders past and present. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Thanks, as always, to the good folk at Earth Matters, serving up rich and textured stories about our planet. I love hearing them. Today on Out of the Blue, we're going to be delving into the fascinating world of governance on the high seas. More after this.
There are all kinds of reasons people end up with issues with alcohol and other drugs, and it's nothing new. Hi, I'm Professor Scott Wilson from the not-for-profit Aboriginal Drug and Alcohol Council. What always helps is to reflect on what life might be like without the substance abuse, and then take action. Step one is simple. See your GP or drug and alcohol worker and ask for help today. You can visit us at adac.org.au.
A 3CR supporter.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
Over this last week, there has been a bit of a storm brewing in the high seas. The International Seabed Authority, or the ISA, is a UN-associated regulator of seabed mining activities in areas beyond national jurisdiction. The ISA's council, made up of 36 members, has been meeting over the last few weeks in Jamaica, where they approved an extension to a mining exploration license to Nauru Ocean Resources Inc., or NORI. This company is a subsidiary of The Metals Company, a Canadian firm which has been trying to circumvent international law by seeking unilateral permission to commence deep sea mining through the US legal system, applying through the Trump administration. What's more, in early July, The Metals Company launched a lawsuit against the International Seabed Authority for its scrutiny of the company's activities. Several organizations, including Greenpeace, have condemned this aggressive litigation, which they say is designed to avoid scrutiny for non-compliance. The ISA is yet to finalize the rules and regulations needed for seabed mining to commence at all, leaving many issues unresolved, even as tech companies ramp up their development of mining technology and infrastructure. So, with these new developments in the deep sea mining space, I thought it would be useful to return to an interview I recorded last year about the governance of the high seas and the seabed, which is quite a complex space. So, to demystify it, here is Alicia Harold-Kolib from the University of Melbourne.
So I'm a marine social ecologist, so I bring together social and ecological questions to think about them in a holistic way. So I spent many years working in sort of conservation biology, marine ecology, and in that role as a conservation biologist, ended up talking to a lot of policymakers. And I guess as many scientists find, it was a little bit frustrating to know that we had good science that wasn't making its way into policy. And so I took a step back from the more physical science and wanted to understand a bit better what was actually happening in the governance space, what's happening in policy, how is policy made. Mm-hmm. And so I actually came back to university and did a PhD looking at the international governance of ocean acidification. So trying to understand how we actually govern emergent environmental problems in the international space.
I'm curious if you found that your previous study in ecology helped you in the kind of policy space. Did you find that those ideas were applicable?
It's a really interesting question because I think I still think like an ecologist. And I think that there are actually many, many analogies, I guess, in the way that social systems work to how ecological systems work, especially things like interconnectivity, how systems don't work independently. It's actually systems as opposed to individual sort of siloed issues. And so I think that that frame has always served me well in thinking about governance and policy. And it certainly has shaped the way I view policymaking as well.
Mm. I also wonder about, like, who are the apex predators in the governance
space?
Yeah,
in terms of power and yeah, definitely. Ecological thinking, but I think thinking about human behaviour helps at any level, whether that be talking to your local politician, whether it be how a local meeting is going, to how do states function. Thinking about human behaviour can actually help explain a lot of the ins and outs of processes of policy making and governance.
Interesting lens. So you mentioned that ocean acidification is what your PhD was on. That kind of occurs in this place that is known as the high seas, which makes up the majority of the planet, but which the majority of humans spend very little time really thinking about or interacting with. So can you define the high seas and what is actually out there?
One little caveat there in terms of ocean acidification happens everywhere. And actually some of the largest impacts are the coastal impacts because they're the places that we interact with most, particularly things like coral reefs, different coastal fisheries, those kinds of things are really impactful for humans in terms of how ocean acidification is affecting us. Mm. In terms of the high seas, so we think about the high seas or areas beyond national jurisdiction as those areas that are not state or country waters. Mm. They're areas that are free for anyone to use. Mm. So they tend to be governed by the norm of freedom of the high seas. You know, often we think of pirates on the high seas, but really things like freedom of navigation, fisheries, all these things can happen on the high seas and happen with different forms of regulation to what we see happening in country waters. So ultimately, if we want to govern a fishery, it has to be a group of countries that come together to decide how that fishery is going to be governed. But ultimately also because it's international waters or the high seas, it's also much harder then to police any decision, and there are different rules around who gets to police it, who gets to actually make the rules. So it's very, very different to sort of national waters.
Have you ever been out on the high seas?
No, I don't think I have.
Would you want to?
Yeah. A lot of my work at the moment is around deep sea mining. I mean, I'd love to get out on a research cruise to have a look at what is being found at the moment with sort of a lot of the deep sea exploration. Yeah. Deep sea ecologists that I know, they basically say every time they go out, they're just finding new species that we've never seen before, which is super exciting. It's just, I guess, a space that most of us will perhaps fly over at some point in our lives, but we don't spend any time out there. I mean, it's beyond 200 nautical miles. Like, it's pretty far out, right? You're not taking a boat out there. So people might spend time on a cruise ship and go into the high seas. But aside from that, most people don't ever interact on a personal level with high seas spaces.
It brings me a lot of fear to think about being that far away from land. I'm definitely a land lover. So I find it really curious that there are certain people who do go out there and interact with them. What benefits do the high seas actually bring to humans?
Yeah, so if we think about the high seas in terms of ecological connection, they're not separate to any other seas from the world, right? So it's one global ocean. We, in this international legal spaces, have decided to zone off, you know, state waters from international waters, but ecological connectivity doesn't adhere to those boundaries. So in that sense, there's ecological flows from the high seas to coastal areas. So high seas fishery populations will seed coastal fisheries. And so those coastal fisheries are often ones that are really important in terms of food security and just feeding people. Mm-hmm. So we've got nutrient cycling, which happens throughout the ocean. Oxygen is produced by plankton in the ocean. We've got carbon sequestration. So the oceans, and particularly the largest part of the oceans, which is the high seas, store a phenomenal amount of carbon dioxide. So if not for the oceans, climate change would be much worse than it currently is. The global ocean absorbs 90% of the heat produced by climate change and around 30% of the carbon dioxide produced by carbon emissions. You know, there's so much every day that we benefit from the ocean without even thinking about it. Oceans are life, really.
I think it's interesting you mentioned the CO2 and the heat that the oceans absorb. And that kind of gets at this idea of the oceans as almost an archive. I once had a teacher who talked about rivers as being, if you look closely at a river, you can see human history in it. If you look into the sediment, you'll find maybe microplastics or pollutants from gold mining. And not just bad things either. There's human folklore and stories and cultural heritage. So I'm wondering, what kind of traces of human history can you find in the high seas?
Really interesting question. I mean, there's, you know, the physical traces that we think of, shipwrecks, those kinds of things. We also have things like human remains throughout the ocean. So one area in particular that has been raised in terms of intersections with deep sea mining is the Middle Passage, which is basically an area that runs between Africa and the Americas. And it was the route that the slave ships took. It's estimated that about 2 million people were thrown overboard or jumped overboard during all of those sort of years of transport. And so there's millions of people, the remains of people along that Middle Passage, which is a space that also is recognised as being productive in terms of a place that companies would like to mine for the minerals found along the seafloor. So there are questions in terms of how do we actually commemorate and protect cultural heritage on the seafloor as well. Then we've also got intangible cultural heritage, which if you speak to many Indigenous and cultural communities around the world, they have very deep connections with the ocean. So whether it be a place that their ancestors reside, whether it be a place that they understand as themselves throughout their history as travelling across the ocean, there are all sorts of connections to the ocean which we don't, in international policy, don't do a very good job of recognising. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we need to do better in the future.
You mentioned that the Middle Passage is a place that is of great interest to deep sea mining companies. And this has kind of become a more visible issue with recently Donald Trump signing an executive order to open both the US and international waters to deep sea mining. So if we got on that research cruise you were talking about, and we went out and saw deep sea mining, can you paint me a picture of what it looks like?
Yeah, so at the moment, most interest is around polymetallic nodules, and the area of greatest interest is in the Pacific Ocean called the Clarion-Clipperton Zone, or the CCZ. So I guess polymetallic nodules are often described as like potato-shaped rocks that sit on the seafloor, and they take hundreds to millions of years to form, and they're a really important ecosystem for lots of little critters that live in the deepest parts of the ocean. The argument is that we need these minerals in order to fuel a clean energy transition. That argument, I think, is not entirely founded on evidence, and I think there are arguments to suggest that with new technologies coming through with recycling, that we won't actually need the minerals from the deep sea floor. So I think that there's a question as to whether we even need to start mining the deep sea. So we haven't started yet. There are conversations going on and negotiations going on at the moment in the International Seabed Authority, which is the international authority that decides what happens to the deep sea floor in areas beyond national jurisdiction. The question with the US is a really interesting one because the US is not party to the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. Mm-hmm. And it's only countries that are party to that that can have a say as to what happens in international waters, really. Mm-hmm. Whereas the US has decided to sort of circumvent that process and has decided to go through a very old existing process that they have to grant deep sea mining licenses. Mm. So the process that the US has predates the international decision and the international negotiations around deep sea mining. So this is the first time we've really seen it activated and the first time that we're likely to see decisions made that allow deep sea mining to happen under the US authority. Mm. So if you think about the biggest bulldozers you can imagine rolling along the seafloor, scooping up these polymetallic nodules, it's a hugely destructive process. Over the last, I think, 2 months, been some research released that looked at mining tracks that are about 40 years old now. And so they went to actually look at have the ecosystems recovered along those mining tracks. And 40 years later, you can still see the mining tracks. So yes, the process back then was even more destructive than what it is now. But ultimately, you can still see those mining tracks on the seafloor. And whilst there is some emergent life in those tracks, there's nothing like the full ecosystem. And that's 40 years later we're talking about. Obviously not seeing the recovery of the nodules themselves, given that they take hundreds of thousands to millions of years to reform. So ultimately we're looking at completely changing the deep sea floor through this process of deep sea mining.
Alicia Harold-Kolib, expert on ocean governance from the University of Melbourne, outlining some of the deeply troubling developments in deep sea mining. You're listening to Out of the Blue on 3CR Community Radio, and we're talking about governance of the high seas. The high seas are the waters that sit beyond 200 nautical miles from the coastline, so they really fall outside of national jurisdictions. Instead, they come under the Freedom of the High Seas principle, which in essence sets out that the high seas belong to nobody, and therefore every nation is free to access them. As for the seafloor, well, this is actually governed very differently. Alicia explains.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. In the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, so we've got areas beyond national jurisdiction, the high seas, and as you said, governed by this norm of freedom of the high seas. The sea floor, however, and areas beyond national jurisdiction, or what is coined in the treaty as the area, is actually governed by a principle of common heritage of humankind. And so this is a principle that actually talks about how important it is that the seafloor not just be used by one or two companies or countries, but actually if the mineral resources of the seafloor are exploited, that it's done on behalf of all of humankind. And so essentially it's a notion that all of humankind sort of owns the seafloor and has a stake in what happens to the seafloor. When the treaty itself was being negotiated, there are a number of developing countries that really pushed back on this notion of freedom of the high seas, which they saw as potentially allowing sort of colonization of the seafloor as they had seen happening to their own countries through colonialism. And so it was really this sort of measure put in place to really ensure that a few rich countries or companies couldn't grab the seafloor in the way that we've seen other sort of land grabbing happen in the past.
Yeah, I think this kind of comes at an interesting part of sort of like this collective heritage of humanity, like how you would share the benefits of deep sea mining.
Yeah, so it's a really interesting question. And I think one of the ways that the common heritage principle has been watered down is by turning it into just a financial benefit sharing mechanism, rather than actually asking the question of what is a benefit to humankind? Is mining even a benefit? And I think there's a question before we even get to the how do we share the benefits, what potentially could be quite small financial benefits, before we start figuring that out, we first actually need to ask what is the benefit and how do we actually ensure that common heritage is a benefit for all of humanity. I would argue that actually not mining the seafloor gives much huger benefits to humanity in terms of not disrupting really important and fragile ecosystems, not disrupting intangible heritage on the seafloor, ensuring that the ocean and one of the last pristine places on Earth remains as pristine as it can for future generations. So I would argue that actually the notion of deep sea mining runs counter to this idea of benefit for humankind. I don't think we actually can say that just a small financial benefit outweighs the much larger benefits of not mining at all. In terms of where the conversations within the negotiations are at around benefit sharing, there is still a lot of details to be worked out, but there are still huge questions about how much financial benefit would even come to states. There are conversations around developing countries should be the ones that really get that benefit sharing, but potentially we're talking about $100,000 a year, being such a small financial outcome, again, suggests that it's not really a benefit for all of humankind. We're trying to put the nice wrapping on what is a benefit for a few companies and potentially a few countries. But it's ultimately about these companies exploiting the seafloor for the benefit of themselves.
Stepping back from the idea of the benefits of that mining to the regulatory processes controlling this mining, so that's kind of still up in the air. They haven't really been defined yet. But how confident are you in the ability of the international community to effectively regulate the industry?
So there is a draft mining code at the moment. Mm-hmm. And with every negotiations, and the ISA meets 2 to 3 times a year to continue going through each provision in the draft mining code. I think the environmental provisions are getting stronger with each conversation. How confident am I that we can regulate effectively? I mean, I think once we start mining, ultimately there will be destruction to the seafloor. And there's not any way that that can then be remediated in the short term. We're talking about millions of years before the seafloor potentially looks again like it looks now. So to me, it's actually a question of, are we as humanity going to allow something like deep sea mining to happen? In the sense that it's potentially not even needed for the energy transition. It's not something that's of benefit to most of humanity. And it's something that is so destructive. So I think that actually there's more of an argument for a genuine moratorium banning deep sea mining than there is for, can we do this and do this in a sustainable way? I don't think we can do it in a sustainable way. If the international community decides that they want to allow deep sea mining to happen, then it's about trying to mitigate as much impact as possible. But there's never not going to be destruction of the seafloor and deep sea ecosystems. It's then just a question of how much.
You mentioned a moratorium on deep sea mining. Is there much movement in that direction?
Yeah, so there's about 32 countries at the moment that have come out and said either a full all-out ban, which France has said, or other countries that have said at least a moratorium until we have better science. One of the big problems about deep sea mining is that we don't even know what's on the seafloor. We don't even understand these ecosystems. We have a good understanding of the fact that they are really important to global processes and that they're some of the most biodiverse spaces on the planet, but we don't actually even know most of the species that exist there. So a number of countries have come out and said, until we have better science, we at least need to have a pause until that point. But there are other countries that are still talking about moving ahead. I think there is the potential that with the moves of the US that could encourage other countries to sign on to a moratorium. On very dark days, I feel like the US could also just create havoc in that countries say, well, the US is not adhering to the rules, the rest of us won't, and then it'll just be a race to the bottom.
The bottom of the ocean.
The bottom of the ocean, no pun intended. But I don't think that's the way it's going to play out. On my more hopeful days, I think that we will manage to avert deep sea mining in areas beyond national jurisdiction.
Where can people follow along if they want to find out more information?
They can look up DOSI, the Deep Ocean Stewardship Initiative. I'm a member of DOSI, and so what we do in DOSI is actually try and ensure that good science is reaching decision makers and making sure that good science is embedded in the negotiations as well. There's also the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition is another place that folks can look. That's the group that's really driving the momentum on the moratorium. And then if it is something they're really interested in, go speak to whoever represents you in government and tell them you don't want deep sea mining to happen.
Alicia Harold-Kolib there, who researches governance of the high seas at the University of Melbourne. Australia is still yet to join the 45 other countries who are calling for a moratorium on deep sea mining. Alicia has also published some really interesting research on this subject, which I'll link to in the show notes. You can find that link along with links to the Deep Sea Ocean Stewardship Initiative, or DOSI, and other resources that Alicia mentioned on the website at 3cr.org.au/radioblue. So it's time for me to get out of the studio, make way for Out of the Pan, coming out with Sally next. Until next time, stay salty, friends.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.